Please pray with me. O God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O God, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. I used to think that God's noticing is what set God apart. That God notices our suffering or others even when we don't. That God has an almost infrared ability to pick up on the silent suffering of others, to notice it with few clues or evidence. I think that may be true about God. God, you search me and you know me, the psalmist writes, when I sit down and when I rise. But the Israelites groaned. They cried out. They voiced their suffering, and their cry rose up to God. And then, after they had voiced their suffering, then God heard, and God remembered God's promises, and God saw, and God noticed. I don't think that what sets God apart is noticing everything, at least not in today's text. It is what God does after God learns of human suffering. The way God refuses to let injustice and suffering go on. Peter Singer, the ethicist and philosopher, says that most human beings are like this to a point. He asks his students to imagine that they are walking to class and they pass by a shallow pond where they see a child who appears to be drowning. To save the child would be easy, he tells his students, but it would mean that you would get muddy and wet, perhaps your clothes would be ruined, and you would definitely miss your first class. And then he asks his students, do you have any obligation to rescue this child? Unanimously, he reports, the students all say yes. There is a moral responsibility to rescue the child. Rescuing the child far outweighs the cost of time or money involved. Does it make a difference, he asks, that other people are walking near the pond and they are not rescuing the child, even though they could? No, the students argue, the fact that others are not doing what they ought to do is no reason why I should not do what I ought to do. And then the professor asks his students another question. Would it make any difference if the child were far away, in another country perhaps, but similarly in danger of death and equally within your means to save at no great cost and absolutely no danger to yourself? Almost everyone agrees, he reports, that distance and nationality make no moral difference in this situation. If there is a possibility of saving the child, we have an obligation to do so. Singer then points out to his students that we are all in that situation of the person passing the shallow pond. We can all save the lives of people, both children and adults, who would otherwise die, and we can do so at very little cost to ourselves. The cost of a Netflix subscription, a shirt, or a night out at a restaurant or a concert can mean the difference between life and death to more than one person somewhere in the world, and he tells them overseas aid agencies overcome the problem, this problem of acting from a distance. It is at this point, Singer reports, that his students start raising all kinds of practical questions. How can they be sure that their money is really going for the purpose stated? What about more systemic problems that need to be addressed to prevent their money from being wasted? It's these questions, these excuses, that differentiate us, I think, from God. We notice suffering just as God notices. We hear the cries that God hears. The pain of others is there for us to see. We just exercise ways of convincing ourselves why others' suffering isn't ours to acknowledge or share or notice. It's these excuses, argues psychologist Scott Plous, that shut down our compassion. We tell ourselves, he says, stories about why it's okay not to help. Why it's okay not to help once. And we say, well, because if I did one, I would have to do 100. And I couldn't possibly do that. But in fact, sometimes you can do one, and one is better than zero. Mr. Falker could have come up with a story of why it would be okay for him not to help Tricia. He could have told himself that he was a young teacher and needed to focus on the entire class, not on one student, that he wasn't perhaps equipped to handle a special needs child, that he didn't have the time or the expertise to address her needs. After all, it wasn't really his fault that she couldn't read. Perhaps it was the teachers before him who had failed to notice. It's not hard to find legitimate excuses for why he shouldn't get involved, which makes me wonder, who shaped Mr. Falker to be this way? Who shaped him to absorb the idea that living your life around others is what living your life is really all about? Who shaped him to think about human need as an opportunity for connection rather than a problem to avoid? Who taught him that ancient wisdom that pleasure is not usually found by pursuing pleasure, but by serving for and with others? I don't know who shaped Mr. Falker, but I know that it's the shaping that we are after here in this church, this place that shapes us to experience the world as God experiences it, attuned to others' suffering, awakened to our own compassion, thankful that while we can't do everything, while we can't serve everyone, while we can't heal everyone, we can do and serve and heal some. One is better than zero. The church exists to shape us into followers of a God whose purpose, whose mission, whose life is tied to the well-being of others. People who attune our lives to God's compassionate instincts and impulses. It's that mission that drives our life. It's that mission that demands the best from us, our time, our prayers, our money. Shaping a people whose love for God and love for justice in the world are inseparable. Sometimes I think that shaping makes us into a kind of odd people. People who are talking about how to be more compassionate in a country that wants to send refugees home. People who are wanting to learn how to be more generous at precisely the time when most people seem to want to pull back from helping other people around the world. People who are striving to be open at a time when many people in our country think it would be better just to shut everything down. Sometimes I feel that disconnect between the shaping that happens here and the world, the way the world seems to operate. I was in the cell phone store a few weeks ago. We finally got our 10th grader a smartphone. I think we were the last parents to get our 10th grader a smartphone. and the salesperson worked very hard to upsell us to other things. The store is laid out like your home, he told us without any kind of apology, so that you can see all the stuff that will make your life better. Perhaps we might want a smartwatch or smart technology for our home. No thank you. No thank you. Our salesman started to show his frustration. Clearly, we were a miserable people who did not want our lives to be better. And we got to the TV section, and he said, for example, how many TVs do you have in your home currently? And I said, we have one. One? He asked. Yes. You have one TV. Yes. Just one. Just one. Like one flat screen or just one? Just one. I leaned in to protect my children from this obvious shame. We keep it in the basement, I told him. Well, what do you do if two of you want to watch something at the same time? He demanded. You're not going to believe this, I told him, but we talk to each other. And sometimes we work it out. Or, I said, we read books instead. Some nights, I told him, we don't even watch TV. We play something called board games. Sometimes we just sit and talk. It occurred to me later that what happens in our congregation, the shaping of a people to be attentive to each other and attentive to God's grace in the world, a people who practice generosity in a time where scarcity and fear is in vogue, a people who look for God amidst the world's suffering, might just be more and more odd, more and more marginal to the mainstream. And yet, it's like the psychologist said, one is better than zero. One human being whose life and call is shaped by God's compassion, God's attention to others suffering, by the truth that our deepest meaning is found in relationship with others. One human being shaped like that to know the depth of God's love and the vocation that love issues, that is a gift, not just to us and for us, but for the world. Just ask Patricia Polacco. She writes some of the most moving, compassionate children's books of any contemporary author, stories of Christians and Jews sharing with each other from the best of our traditions, stories of immigrants honoring each other's traditions, stories of bullies healed of their racism and their emptiness, stories of teachers and parents and storekeepers and good citizens shaped to be attentive to each other's suffering. Those stories didn't come to her by accident. She was shaped by someone. I know this because she tells us at the end of the book that I read, in the last page, the Tricia of the book, we learn, is actually Patricia Polacco, the author. I saw Mr. Falker again some 30 years later at a wedding, she recalls. I walked up to him and introduced myself. At first, he had difficulty placing me. And then I told him who I was and how he had changed my life so many years ago. He hugged me and asked me what I did for a living. "Why, Mr. Falker," answered the student, who could have gone through her life never able to read. "I make books for children." Thank you, Mr. Falker. Thank you. I know that in these times we may wonder just how much the church is able to do in Baltimore or in any other part of the world. I can't answer that with any sort of specificity. But I know this: we can do something, and one is always better than zero.